Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, turning the idea of a witch hunt upside down. We'll spend this hour with New York Times columnist Lindy West, who says if feminists are going to be characterized as witches, making things hard for powerful men with the Me Too movement, so be it. But expect the witches to do the hunting. We'll also talk with West about politics, pop culture, and why she thinks women should talk openly about abortions they do not regret. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
Powerful men accused of sexual misconduct have plenty of defenders, but those defenders tend to invoke the same metaphor to describe the process by which these men have been called out for alleged bad behavior. It's a witch hunt against as wide an array of luminaries as Brett Kavanaugh, Aziz Ansari, Louis C.K., and Charlie Rose. The thing is, you know, women were not the hunters in the witch hunts of old. They were the prey. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. New York Times columnist Lindy West was initially skeptical at this postmodern take on the witch hunt in which the women who say they've been harmed by men are recast as the aggressors, daring to go public with stories of how they've been harmed. But West has come around on this. Okay, she says, if you want to call this a modern day witch hunt, go ahead. But be prepared for what happens when all these witches, which is to say women, band together to hunt down the bad guys. The new book of essays by Lindy West is called The Witches Are Coming. She joins us from Minnesota Public Radio to talk about it. Lindy, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why is it such a go-to move for people accused of wrongdoing to paint themselves as the real victim?
I think it's just a really effective rhetorical tactic, rhetorical maneuver, because it puts your accuser on the defense. It's so much more powerful than just saying, oh, no, I didn't do that. But to say, to barrel past that and say, actually, in fact, I am being victimized by this accusation. People don't have a script for dealing with that. We're used to, I think, defaulting to compassion, and especially for certain kinds of people. It really throws off the conversation and takes you into a realm where you're really discussing nonsense. You know, of course, if you have done something wrong and are seeing some accountability, you are not being victimized by that accountability.
You know, what's really interesting is, of course, there's no shortage of people who feel as if powerful men who abuse their status to do bad things to women have been unfairly maligned. There's also this narrative that calling them out kind of emasculates men.
Their narrative.
That somehow being called out on this bad behavior is a form of women trying to take all the power.
I see. Well, it would only be fair for us to take all the power for, I don't know, maybe 1,000 years, and then we would be even. But in fact, that's not what anyone's asking for. We're asking for things like maybe one woman could be president one time since you've had 45 in a row. The idea that that any progress amounts to this absolutely unjust theft of power. It really implies that power belongs to men rightfully, and that we are somehow, you know, usurpers who are unfairly taking something from them, where in fact, this is not the case. If you really believe in justice and equality, then all of these spaces and, you know, political spaces, cultural spaces, systems of power should be ours to control just as much. And it's also, I think, needlessly adversarial. Why should our ends be necessarily at odds? You know, why can we not be human beings trying to build a society together that looks like the kind of just and safe and equal place that we all supposedly want to live in?
What do you think separates men who are supportive of kind of new rules that will protect everyone, empower women, from men who can only think about what they lose if women are allowed to make some of the rules?
I think people are always afraid of change and of losing status and losing power and losing money. You know, obviously, also we've lived in very dysfunctional systems for a long time. And I think if you start that really empower certain people at the expense of others. And if you start to acknowledge those systems and look at them, especially if you're a beneficiary of one of those systems, suddenly you have to confront the fact that you were complicit in some very dark things. Even if you didn't personally, you weren't personally a perpetrator of sexual violence, or you know, whatever system we're talking about, you still have benefited. And that's really scary for people who want to think of themselves as good people. And so I think resisting the change as a whole, I think is easier than dipping into the nuance.
Apologizing is also really scary for people. I was unaware of the complicated backstory of Grumpy Cat, but this was like a pretty remarkable example of people who made a bad thing 1,000 times worse by refusing to just stop and consider the harm they might have caused and saying they were sorry.
I mean, allegedly. I have no proof that this story is that my take on the story is correct, but I believe that it is. It certainly feels, it smells off. And yeah, I mean, I think people really, really hate to apologize. It is scary and it can be painful, but I have always found, like, obviously everyone hates to get called out for doing something wrong or doing something hurtful or participating in an oppressive system. But I've always found that every time I've been called out on making a mistake in a piece of writing or saying the wrong thing on the radio, I'm grateful. You know, it's a gift and it's an opportunity to do better in the future. And that's what I want. I want to do better. So, yeah, I mean, my bigger point in that chapter is it's not even about the, you know, the missed opportunity to hold oneself accountable, but the fact that the rest of us, you know, the public at large, is eager to pave over, you know, to sort of paper over these mistakes too. We all want to live in a comfortable place where our favorites are never problematic, and that's just not a healthy world.
So for people who are desperately Googling this now, trying to figure out what
sorry.
It is. So if I have this right, the people who owned that cat who's sort of angry looking face became the subject of memes everywhere had given it originally a name that was offensive.
I know. And I didn't tell the story because I wasn't sure how to talk about it on the radio.
But maybe you can talk around the word.
I'll tiptoe around it. Yeah. So RIP Grumpy Cat, I should say. The cat has passed away and it's very sad. But the story that I tell in the book is that the cat, can I say the cat's name? The original name?
The original name referred to a derogatory term used to slur people with cognitive disabilities.
Yes. And then there was a sort of backlash to this, as there always is on social media when the cat became famous and then people found out the cat's name. And then the owners of the cat, rather than maybe saying, yeah, we gave the cat that name because it's a special needs cat with facial differences. They sort of, in my opinion, seem to have invented a backstory where the cat's name is tartar sauce, like the sauce, but spelled wrong. I don't know. It just feels like the kind of, you know,
like really
excuse
convoluted.
That you make up. Really convoluted, like when you're panicking, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it just, I feel like it would have been so much easier. People would love to forgive the famous cat that they love, but they were equally happy to just accept the story and move on. And I think that that's a kind of American disease that we all fall victim to, is we want to have this kind of amnesia and we want to rewrite reality to make ourselves more comfortable.
Like if, say, you really love Fixer Upper and then you find out something about its host that you didn't want to know.
I still love it. for people who don't follow the minutiae of minor pop culture events, Chip and Joanna Gaines, who I love, hosts of the show Fixer Upper, although I think it ended and they're now starting their own television network because they are taking over Earth. There was a scandal maybe a year or two ago. I can't remember when. BuzzFeed posted an expose about they had discovered that Chip and Joanna go to a mega church that has where the pastor has expressed homophobic views and has expressed support specifically for conversion therapy for gay and LGBTQ youth. So that's really bad. That's a bad, very, very inhumane, dangerous practice. And there's this big disconnect between these sort of beloved, very, very sweet, very charming TV figures and this really, really abhorrent, dangerous belief system and practice of conversion therapy. And so when this came out, there was some people were mad that BuzzFeed were delving into Chip and JoJo's personal life. Some people were rightfully mad about the tacit approval of conversion therapy. And their response wasn't to apologize. It was to say, we love everyone and we're not prejudiced. Thanks, bye. Which I think is a really missed opportunity to engage with a really complicated situation where, you know, we don't know anything about their personal lives. How often do they go to church? Do they agree with the pastor? Do they go to this church for, you know, other reasons? They're enmeshed in this community and it would be complicated to leave. Are they trying to change the church from inside? But all we know is that the pastor calls them dear friends and he is a virulent homophobe, which is unacceptable in 2019 in America. I'm sorry, it just is. And so either it's again this sort of impulse to jump into the PR mode and just get out of it, wriggle out of the accountability rather than engage with it and maybe I don't know, let your audience trust you and feel like you are a reachable, teachable, oh, that sounds so corny, you know, real human being who cares about them.
So what is our obligation as like audience members? How much do we need to know about the people that we admire? I mean, you know, you could argue that their whatever their personal beliefs are have nothing to do with how they decorate a house. It does speak to what kind of people they might be, but we don't really have great information about that. Like, how much due diligence do I have to do before I flip on HGTV?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. Obviously, we can't do a deep dive background check into every single person on every single television show. And nor should we. I mean, that would be ludicrous. And, you know, if a person were to keep their political beliefs in a locked box and go vote for truly horrific policies every chance they got, but they were a beloved TV figure and we never knew, we would never know. And that's just reality. And that's honestly fine. But I think that all we can do as viewers is just think critically about what our values are. And it's really not about making rules about what you can and can't watch or who you have to investigate. It's more just like, okay, so now every time I turn on a rerun of Fixer Upper, I think about that pastor and I think about conversion therapy. And it makes me not want to watch it. And that is... that's just reality. That's not me making some kind of PC legislation. It's just part of my life now, and it affects what I want to watch. It affects where I want to spend my time and my dollars. And Chip and JoJo can take that however they want. They can maybe they care, maybe they don't. And certainly they're not hurting for audience members. They're doing great. They have a magazine and, a television network and a store and a home remodeling business, I assume. So it's really just about all of us sort of navigating this complicated world one day at a time and making choices that align with our values, whatever feels right.
My guest is New York Times columnist Lindy West. Her new book is called The Witches Are Coming.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times columnist Lindy West, whose newest book is called The Witches Are Coming. All right, Lindy, what did you learn growing up from TV and the movies about how to be a likable and desirable woman?
Oh, well, I write about this in the book, and I also wrote about it in my last book. I guess I'm obsessed, slightly pop culture obsessed. You know, I didn't see myself growing up in the media much at all, you know, as like a fat kid and a fat teenager. There really weren't any people who looked like me who weren't sort of kindly old nursemaids or like Ursula the Sea Witch. You know, the idea that I could have a vibrant, successful, happy life in the body that I had was just not presented to me in media. And beyond that, you know, the girl characters that I did encounter growing up, or the women, the sort of models of womanhood that were in my field of vision were, you know, very, you know, just often very passive and very, you know, focused on being nurturing and very secondary to male characters who were the center of the story and who were powerful and who got to go out and act upon the world in a way that I just never felt like was my place. And also, you know, the sexual politics in movies and TV growing up were very, I mean, we're very familiar with them still because we're just kind of working through them right now. But it was normal. It was normal in movies for a man to pursue a woman romantically, and if she rejected him, that wasn't a no, it was an invitation to try harder.
Right.
And these were called romantic comedies. So there were just a lot of really, really toxic, but also just kind of really confusing messages growing up that I think we're all still processing right now. I mean, that's a lot of what Me Too is about. It's sort of climbing out of some of these toxic systems that we built over the last, you know, the last forever.
You have the sense that Hollywood like could be really groundbreaking in terms of introducing the possibilities of being kinder and more inclusive. Why has that mostly not happened?
Well, I mean, everything is capitalism, right? Everything is marketing. And we have these really entrenched ideas about what beauty is and what desirability is for both men and women. And sort of, you know, for my entire lifetime, it's been one very, very narrow standard, which is, you know, a thin, white, conventionally attractive woman. And, you know, who has no disability, who is straight, who is cisgender. You know, we know what this person looks like. And that's what's been presented to us as the sort of desirable version of a woman. And it's, I think, very lucrative for the diet industry and the beauty industry. And it's really harmed a lot of us. It's really kept a lot of women chasing that standard for their whole lives and spending a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of energy trying to achieve something that is essentially impossible. And so, you know, Hollywood sold us that version of a person, of an ideal person. But And it was so powerful, and it's inside of us in such an intense, such a deep, powerful way. But on the flip side, they could sell us a different version. You know, they could, and I say they, but I now have a television show.
Right.
And this is something that we think about all the time on the show. You know, who are we casting in these roles? Whose stories are we telling? Because media really is powerful. Communication is really powerful, and representation, who people see on their screens, whose stories they are taught to relate to, absolutely changes how they think about themselves and how they think about the people around them.
So you were working, this is the series Shrill that's on Hulu. It's a fictionalized account of your first book, starring Adie Bryant. You're working with source material. On the other hand, you do have suddenly this power to sort of make choices that kind of tell a story the way you've wanted it to be told. How do you strike the balance between sort of being empowered to make the kind of choices that you think ought to be happening all the time in Hollywood and like not veering over into after-school special territory?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's something else that we talk about all the time in the writer's room and on set. But the fundamental rule that we keep in mind in every choice that we make is that we're making a piece of art. We're making a piece of entertainment. We're making a television show. Above all, we're trying to make a television show that people want to watch. Because otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, all the your politics are you're not serving your politics if you make some boring polemic that no one's interested in. So, you know, above all, we always keep our eye on story and on, you know, the craft itself of making something that appeals to people. But within that, there are so many choices that you can make. And I don't think that the two are at odds. I don't think that it's a worse story if you have a diverse writer's room and a diversity of experiences and perspectives in your show. I think that that's a better story because we have heard so many of the same stories so many times. And it's good for the form to have life in it and to have, you know, also I think that politics and art and storytelling are not actually at odds. You know, I think if you want your work to be alive in the world, it has to be related to what's happening around us in some way. It has to have some traction in real life. And so I think it's absolutely to the show's benefit that we think every day about diversity and representation and who we're talking to and who we're talking about and who we're centering in our story.
My understanding is that you knew from the outset that you wanted to include an abortion scene in the series. Let's listen to part of that before we talk about it.
They actually said I can have a support person, which means that you can come in with me.
Of course I will.
Okay, Annie, I'm just going to finish numbing you now. You might feel some light cramping. You might also feel some numbing in your tongue or ringing in your ears, okay?
Okay.
You okay?
Now I'm opening your cervix. Some cramping is normal. Everything looks great, and we're about 2/3 of the way finished now.
You're doing great, Annie. Almost done.
All right. I think what was so interesting to me, Lindy, when I first watched that was that even though it's not a particularly dramatic scene, it occurred to me that this broke all the rules about every abortion scene or discussion that exists in almost any other movie or television show because it's not dramatic and it's not something that is presented as sort of the end of the world for this character.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely an almost mundane scene by design because, you know, there's a reason why it's in the first episode of the series and not the last episode. You know, it's not this sort of melodramatic climax in her story. It's actually a really empowering moment for her where she's making a choice about her own future and what she wants for herself and what she deserves and, you know, who she wants to be in a relationship with, all of these things. You know, she's really stepping into the driver's seat and out of the passenger seat of her own life in a way that is really powerful. And what we wanted to do is reflect another kind of abortion story that isn't typically told on television or in media or really, I mean, we don't talk about abortion much at all. In mainstream culture. And, you know, that's by design. It's been really actively stigmatized and turned into this taboo. And the result is that we don't tell the truth about abortion. And the reality is that there are many, many people having abortions, just like the character in Shrill, Annie, where this is a choice that they're making. They're not conflicted about it. It's not agonizing and traumatic. You know, it might be complicated. It might be emotional, but really, you know, if this is a constitutional right, it's a fundamental human right to have autonomy over your body. And it doesn't have to we, you know, people who are pro-choice, like I am, I don't want to let anti-choice people be the only people talking about abortion. And I'm really grateful to you for playing the audio of that whole scene. Thank you very much. I think it's really, really important for people to know that that people are having abortions all the time. And a lot of them look like this, you know, because that's just, it's just the truth. It's just the truth. It's not propaganda. It's not spin. It's just actual reality. And I think it's really important for us to reckon with that reality, even if, or especially if it makes some people uncomfortable.
The other thing that really surprised me about the reaction to the series, Lindy, was so much of the media coverage, like, was really obsessed with the fact that Aidy Bryant is a fat actress, as if that's like, this is a show that is going to deal every scene, every moment with this part of her life. And it's just, you know, to the same extent that all of our bodies are part of how we move through the world and how we, you know, deal with people and things, it's part of her life, but it's not like a show about her fatness.
Right. It's an interesting line, because we really desperately wanted to do both kind of opposing things. We wanted to make a show about being a fat woman that isn't about being a fat woman, you know. Yeah. I think which seems like a contradiction, but, you know, yes, her body and the way that people treat her because of her body affects every single moment of her day. But it's also not the totality of who she is. In fact, it's a very small part of who she is. And Annie has a really big, vibrant, dynamic, interesting life. She has friends and relationships, and she has a career, and she has, you know, all the same worries and pleasures as any other person. She just has this added layer of challenges that the world serves to her because of what her body looks like. And so we tried to, again, it's kind of the same as the political angle. We tried to, above all, tell a good story, because it is a good story, you know?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, I'm thinking the scene, I guess there, it happens kind of in multiple ways, but there's a scene when a woman, like, is trying to be helpful and is like, I guess, hands her a card for a gym class or something. And the thought of people thinking that they have the right to give you advice on this. It's like someone coming up to you and saying that haircut is doing you no favors. Like, it's just so strange that people feel this right. If it's something based on your physical body, people feel as if they have the right and the responsibility to counsel you on this.
Oh, and it's constant. It's absolutely constant. People do it in person. They come. I've had people come up to me on the street and hand me pamphlets for diet programs. I've had people try to sell me diet pills in person. You know, strangers coming up to me on the street telling me I'm fat and I need to lose weight. I get emails constantly. And it's really telling, I think, that people feel so entitled to fat people's bodies, like that you have any place, any business telling me what I should be eating and how I should be spending my time, as if you even know what I eat and how I spend right. my time. You know, it's interesting. And it's certainly gendered to an extent. I mean, it feels very similar to the way that people feel comfortable just walking up to pregnant women and touching their stomachs. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I'm not public property. I'm a free person who gets to make my own choices. You don't know why my body looks the way that it looks. It's really staggeringly none of your business.
So I get, you are a tough person. You have, you know, found ways to respond to people. You've responded in your work, and I imagine you respond in your personal life when it's appropriate. But it's still got to hurt when people do stuff that is so ignorant.
Definitely. Although I have now been writing about being fat for 10 years, mm-hmm. and I have truly heard everything. and it's, I'm sure it's lodging somewhere in my brain that will come back to bite me later in therapy. But you know, for the most part, like, I am very tough when it comes to people telling me that I'm fat. Like, yeah, I mean, that's why I started writing about it, because it takes the teeth out of someone telling you you're fat. Hmm. If you already wrote I'm fat 1,000 times,
yeah.
It's like someone comes up and tells me I'm fat. It's like, yeah, I know. That's like half my career. but I mean, it is difficult just on a human level to be confronted with the fact that we live in such a inhospitable, angry world. And also because we know that people who are that obsessed with bodies, that they would come up to me on the street and tell me that I need to lose weight and here's how, those are people who are really struggling with their own bodies. And everyone lives in the same system of these very narrow beauty standards, and everyone is tormented by them to some extent. And so it makes me really sad on multiple levels, for myself, but also for people who are in so much pain that they would try to inflict that kind of pain on other people. It's really, really, it's really tragic.
You write about Joan Rivers really sort of capitulating to those impossible standards that she was expected to meet.
Yeah, I think Joan Rivers is so interesting. My experience with Joan Rivers as a young person was always Joan Rivers doing sort of fashion commentary, which was constantly about how fat and ugly every single actress was and how bad she looked in that dress. And I mean, talk about seeping into my psyche and poisoning me. It was really difficult because Joan Rivers is also a comedy hero and a genius, and I think someone who really lived in that pain in a very visible way. And I find her very, very moving and fascinating and dark.
My guest is New York Times columnist Lindy West. We're talking about her most recent book, The Witches Are Coming. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is New York Times columnist Lindy West. We're talking about her newest book, The Witches Are Coming. You can join us, and that's where we find Dan on the line in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Dan.
Hi. So I've been feeling very grateful to my wife, who's really helped call me out and educate me on issues regarding women because she's a woman, issues regarding the LGBT community because she's queer, and about people with disabilities because she's a special ed teacher. And myself, as an Asian American, I find myself all the time out there educating people about representation, about stereotypes, about attitudes towards Asian Americans and people of color. And I guess my question or concern is, how much of that work has to be done by us? How much of that emotional labor is always carried by us versus, you know, sometimes I hear my friends saying, like, to their white friends or to their straight friends or to their male friends, say, like, go look it up. Don't ask me about it. Like, go Google it. But, like, can we really trust people to educate themselves in that way? Or do we always have to be on the front lines and doing this kind of work?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, such a great question and really a central, deep question to, you know, the work of progress. I write about this in the book that I wish so desperately that men, especially in male spaces, would spend some time and take a little risk and take on some of the discomfort that comes with calling out misogynist behaviors when they hear it or see it. Because for the most part, you're totally right. That work falls to marginalized people to do, to demand their humanity over and over and over, try to educate the people around them, which of course comes with consequences. People feel alienated by that. You know, people don't like being called out. And it's very uncomfortable. And I remember having a conversation with two, you know, straight white male friends of mine and saying, you know, when you are around your guy friends and they're talking about women in a degrading way, do you ever say anything? And one of them said, well, I've tried to before, but everyone made fun of me. It's like, yeah, everyone makes fun of me all the time. Mm. I have a widespread reputation for being no fun on the internet. And it's not fair because I'm very fun. And at the same time, you run a risk because you don't want white people to center themselves in the fight against racism. You know, there's a risk of people kind of taking over, right, and sucking up all the oxygen. But there's certainly a balance. There's certainly some place that is better and more productive than where we are now, because to some extent, marginalized people, we are not, we don't have institutional power. We can't fix it to some extent. We can put pressure in the right places, but, you know, women didn't invent misogyny. People of color didn't invent racism. And we need allies who are willing to feel uncomfortable to take on some of that work. And unfortunately, it's difficult to convince people to feel discomfort, but it's absolutely necessary.
Why did you take yourself off Twitter?
Oh, well, Twitter is very bad. Have you been there?
have you seen it? I don't spend a lot of time, but yes.
No, you know, I was really aggressively trolled, or as I like to call it, abused, stalked, and harassed, mm-hmm, for many years, and, which is one of those consequences bestowed upon squeaky wheels who don't shut up about injustice, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. And a lot of people think that that's why I left, but really, I swear, I was very used to it. I was very used to being harassed every day. And the thing that broke me was the way that Donald Trump, who is the president, unfortunately, uses Twitter. He harasses private citizens. He harasses other world leaders. He threatens people. If there's one thing he's good at, it's Twitter. He is good at making a spectacle on Twitter. And it just seemed to me that, for example, perhaps starting a war with North Korea should certainly be against Twitter's terms of service. And I just suddenly felt very dirty being there. I just didn't want to swim in the pool with Donald Trump anymore. And I feel like Twitter as a corporation, and of course many of us have been saying this long before the 2016 election, but Twitter needs to figure out how to protect their users who are actually trying to use the service as it was intended and who are actually abiding by the terms of service, rather than making sure that it's a safe place for Donald Trump and, you know, neo-Nazis to gather. So I had to go. And my life is much quieter now, and I love it.
Is there anything you miss?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I mean, Twitter's really fun. I was really good at Twitter. I loved being a part of these cultural conversations as they're happening, you know. I feel disconnected from the discourse, which is maybe a corny term. But, I feel like I get my news on a delay. Twitter is deeply embedded in all of our lives at this point. And many of our lives. And I think it's really unfair that people people who don't traditionally have a voice, a mainstream voice, who don't have institutional power and then do have access to this communication tool where they can speak directly to their representatives, or they can tell their stories and make their voices heard, you know, so trans people, people of color, disabled people, sex workers, these are people who are disproportionately targeted and harassed on Twitter. And they're the people who are chased away from the platform. And that's profoundly unjust. And so I don't endorse leaving Twitter. I don't think that I should have had to. I don't think that anyone should, unless they're using the platform to harm other people. I'm resentful that I'm not on Twitter, and I miss like joking around with my friends, and like magical things happen on Twitter. Sometimes like a movie star will follow you, and it's very, very confusing. I don't get to have any of that anymore, because of Donald Trump.
Before I picked up this book, I would have told anyone who asked that I had zero interest in all the details of what happens at a Gwyneth Paltrow Goop wellness retreat. But then I realized, no, I've just been waiting for you, Lindy West, to tell me all the details of what happens. Why did you sign up for this?
Because I was paid to by the Guardian newspaper. I just find it really fascinating. I think on two levels, like there's like a lofty version that I could tell you about the ways that I think it's another way that women are expected to spend extravagant amounts of money to perfect ourselves. Mm-hmm. And sort of also the ways that the very, very privileged find to spend their time and money. I think that's really interesting right now in a very grim time of great inequality and crisis. I went and spent a day in a big airplane hangar, or I don't know what it was, some giant building, talking about quote unquote wellness, in the context of, like, for example, putting a leech on your tailbone to suck out toxins so you don't get fat.
Wow.
And when I think about wellness, or, you know, when, like, I don't know, I would say that my first thought would be universal health care, you know, access to medical care, maybe not separating families at the border. There are all kinds of ways in which women are unwell, and needing a leech on your butt is not one of them necessarily. Mm. It's not one that I would go to in the first 1,000. And I think there's something really kind of fascinating and bizarre about that. And I think it deserves examination. At the same time, what I found there was a community of people who were connecting with each other in ways that were clearly very nurturing. And, who knows what kinds of connections they made with each other and the ripple effects that had. You know, I think that community is really powerful and can be harnessed in very productive ways. It's really interesting. I'm not here to just make fun of it, even though some parts deserve it. And then it's also just kind of a kitschy, hilarious thing to participate in. It cost minimum $500. The cheapest ticket was $500. So it's this like very exclusive scene that I wouldn't have had access to if, a newspaper hadn't paid for it so that I could go. And I don't know, there's just something very juicy about getting to peek inside.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go back to the phones. We have Melissa on the line in Richardson, Texas. Hi, Melissa.
Hi there. I was wondering why it takes some men having daughters of their own to realize what women are going through. You know, they say, hey, I don't want anybody to touch my daughter. I don't want anybody to limit their potential. I don't want to silence their ideas. Have you noticed that also? And how can we involve them more in the change that we need going forward?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because on some level, men are not conditioned to think of women as full human beings. I think that our culture presents the sort of default human being as a man, and more specifically a white man, a straight white man. And women are secondary, and women are sort of the support staff in a certain way. You know, we're here to be caregivers. We're here to be nurturers and mothers. And I think it's really hard. And I'm not even saying, you know, these are very deeply ingrained subconscious ideas. I'm not saying that every man who says, you know, I had this epiphany when I had a daughter is a horrible person. But I think it's really interesting that's something that it takes for you to see a woman as a peer, you know, as someone who deserves the same kind of autonomy that you expect for yourself. But I do think that there are plenty of men who just were raised to sort of unconsciously think that way, who do want to move into the future and be a part of progress. And I don't know. I don't know the, if I knew, look, if I knew how to get men on board with, for example, feminism, I would have done it. So I don't know. But I do think that, you know, things like this cultural moment, like Me Too, for example, where what we have is a collective outpouring of truth, of people telling stories that they have previously been afraid to tell, or they've tried to tell and they've been shut down and silenced. I think that that kind of communication and really airing out that those hidden pockets of rot that have just been allowed to fester, I think it's really healthy. And I think that there are men who are capable of listening. Oh, that sounds so condescending. you know, I just think that there's something so powerful about using our voices all at once, collectively, all at the same time. I think it makes it so much harder to dismiss and to shut down. And that's what we've seen. I mean, that's where, you know, it's not like people had never heard a story about Harvey Weinstein being a creep before. But it was easy to knock them down one by one until there were, you know, 35 on the same day. and people were telling the same stories and supporting each other and not being cowed. So I don't have a perfect answer. But I think that we're doing it, you know? I think that in my opinion, you know, this administration is a backlash to progress. You know, I think we were moving and we were gaining some ground. And this is an attempt to grab some of that power back. And I mean, it was shocking to me, you know, when the Access Hollywood tape came out, I remember thinking, you know, with great, honestly, like great compassion for conservatives, especially, I mean, conservative women and men, you know, I remember writing, like, do you want this man's hands on your daughter? Do you, I mean, you know, not to appeal to that same construct that only having daughters can make a man care about, you know, sexual predation or any of these issues. But truly, are you okay with that? And it's honestly still baffling to me that people are able to set those feelings aside and vote for this person. It hurts, you know, it makes me sad, but, I do believe in progress and hope. And I do believe that most men are good, even if they make mistakes.
Lindy West is a columnist for the New York Times. Her new book of essays is called The Witches Are Coming. Lindy, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. You can use any podcast app you prefer to sign up for the Think podcast and check out upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.